Now in the middle of our Olympic Games, I was left with the unenviable task of securing an Olympic thrower from our group of roadrunners, something no coach had ever done in the history of athletics. Because here the problem lay in the fact that these men were harriers with about as much experience of field events as they had of sumo wrestling. But David Putnam resolutely refused to budge, and I therefore assembled my Liverpool lads and asked them if there was anyone amongst them who had any experience of throws. Only one hand went up, that of Arthur, a surprisingly big lad for a harrier, and I immediately enlisted him for discus and hammer. Instinctively cautious, I decided to deploy lighter implements, which meant a 5-kilo hammer and a 1.5-kilo discus, the weights normally used by junior throwers. After all, who on earth would know what weight they were throwing? After slinging a couple of safe single-turn hammer throwers up the middle in practice, my man Arthur looked supremely confident as he entered the circle, his hammer dangling loosely from his right hand. "Action!" bellowed Hugh Hudson. As I have said, I had decided for safety reasons upon a simple single-turn throw, rather than one using the more risky conventional three turns. Arthur made two preparatory swings, but rushed it, lurching into a clumsy half-turn, and dispatched his hammer to his right, into the camera crew, who miraculously survived without injury. I decided against a second attempt, and now handed Arthur his 1.5-kilo discus, advising a simple, risk-free standing technique, and he managed it in a practice throw to sling it safely up the middle to about 30 metres. "Action!" bellowed Hudson. But it was to be no different. Arthur's discus decided to take pretty much the same route as its friend the hammer, fortunately scything its way over the heads of our nimble camera crew. But all was not over. My last desperate hope now lay in the pole vault, where Liverpool Harriers had gone back to the club and found me Paddy, a seasoned young pole vaulter who had cleared over 4 metres, albeit with a fiberglass pole. But I had been lucky. There was no need to make Paddy's pole look like the bamboo poles used back in 1924, for, while we had been at Golden Acre in Edinburgh, by some miracle I'd located in the shadowy depths of the stand an ancient bamboo vaulting pole, which had probably lodged there since well before the Second World War. I managed to get David Putnam to slip the groundsman a £5 note, and the ancient bamboo pole had been brought down to the Wirral. Paddy, as a fiberglass vaulter, did not realise that bamboo vaulters had, unlike fiberglass vaulters, shifted left hands up to right in the plant of the pole in the box. But he was a physically literate lad, and he soon got the idea and was ready to vault into a modern foam landing area, one which would not be visible on film. Action! Paddy surged in and made a superb pole plant to the back of the box with an excellent shift of his hands. But my ancient bamboo pole immediately exploded, scattering its splinters far and wide, for it had been close on 40 years since such outrageous demands had been made upon it, and this had been the last straw. Fortunately, Paddy, ever the survivor, had landed safely on his back in the foam landing area, so all was well. And so ask me not why there appeared to be no field events in the Chariots 1924 Olympic Games. For I have no qualms of conscience. None. I did my best. But my best was simply not good enough. But we still did have the 400 metres hurdles final, albeit with the fictitious Lord Lindsay, and Nigel Havers, who is now hurdling superbly. Then, with only 2 days to go, I was approached by a tall French athlete who announced himself as Yves Beniton. "Mr. Putnam has told me to report you for coaching," he said. "Which event?" I asked. "The 400 metres hurdles," he replied. "Have you ever hurdled before, Yves?" I asked. Yves shook his head. "No," he said, "only le jogging." I was now in a quandary, as we now only had 2 days to go. Yves was playing Georges André, the French athlete who had recited the Olympic Oath, and who had eventually finished fifth in the 400-metre hurdles. My main aim with Eves would be to produce a simple, primitive hurdles technique and to at all costs avoid injury. It was therefore fortunate that we would film only the final three hurdles, a point in the race when athletes tend to stutter and lose their form. That first day, I took Eves through some walkovers over low hurdles to provide him with a basic vocabulary. Then the next day, he undertook some hurdling from a measured seven-stride approach, which went surprisingly well. The Olympic 400-metre hurdles final went like a dream, when the imaginary Nigel Havers hurdling to his imaginary silver medal and Eves going well beyond his potential, finishing in fifth place. To save expense, he was immediately levered into his dishevelled little Honda and set on his way back to Paris. Legend has it that when Eves arrived there, he was so stiff that his girlfriend had to have the car door removed in order that they might reasonably hope to continue the relationship. So now there was only Eric Liddell's 400 metres final to complete the Olympic competitive sequences. Here again, there had to be a slight departure from reality, because back in 1924, the first 200 metres was run on a straight, though do not ask me why. But for Hugh Hudson, one reality had to be retained, and that was the fall of the American John Taylor, about 30 metres from the finish of the race. I had, in my time as a goalkeeper in Glasgow, hit the harsh industrial cinders of its playing fields on many occasions, returning to my mother with bloodied legs, so there could be no faking, and certainly no second takes. Our John Taylor was an athletic young Canadian actor called Colin Bruce, and he came to me and suggested that I might try to negotiate a fee for his fall with David Putnam. I agreed and duly approached the great man. £50, he answered. £100, I replied. Done, said Putnam. Colin Bruce did not disappoint us and duly made a marvellous fall. And half an hour later, he stood naked before me in the shower, the blood still trickling down his legs and arms. He grinned as I handed him a thick wad of £10 notes. Our 1924 Olympics were now at an end, and I made my way south, where there were still a few more dribs and drabs to be filmed, most of which would never make the screen. But one scene did. Colin Welland had always been fascinated by my tale of the hurdler Don Finlay, who had placed matchboxes on top of each hurdle, which he would try to graze with his trail leg. It was no matter that Finlay had been an Olympian hurdler 12 years later in Berlin, or that he had been a 110-metre hurdler. But Colin, he had decided that matchbox, that would be too plebeian for our imaginary Lord Lindsay. No, we would have glasses of iced champagne, perilously perched on the left of each hurdle, held on by sellotape. And so it was, though I do seem to remember that we used a young Scottish double for most of the sequences on that blazing hot day at this Buckinghamshire manor. At the end of shooting, desperately thirsty, I decided that a wee glass of iced champagne would suit me just fine. I detached a glass from a hurdle and slugged it down in one. Alas, it was lukewarm, and worst of all, it was ginger beer. So, at last, it was all over. But no, it ain't over till it's over, because a few weeks later, I received a telephone call from David Putnam. "We've had a response from Hollywood to our first rough cut," he said. "They don't like it. They think that it's too long, by about 20 minutes. So could you go over to Radlett and sit with our editor, Terry Rawlings? See if there's anything that you think we can take out of the athletic sequences." So, soon I was watching the athletic sections of the film for the first time with the famous editor, Terry Rawlings, who had just finished a movie with Barbara Streisand. But, if anything, I felt there was too little athletics in Chariots, and I said so to David Putnam, that he'd have to make his cuts elsewhere. Thus, the 11 minutes of athletics stayed. Removed were a sequence featuring a shipboard romance with Ruby Wax and a Paris Thé Dansant scene, and another where Liddell ran against an ugly man who was given the name of McNab. All then went quiet for several months, and then, in April 1981, I was to see Chariots for the first time in a tiny Soho Square studio cinema with a group of my athletes who enjoyed it immensely, as did I. Then, about a week or so later, David Putnam asked me if I might host a BBC critic by name of Judith Chalmers at the same cinema, and I agreed to do so. Judith was nothing if not frank as we made our way into the studio after a couple of drinks. "Before we start, I want to make one thing absolutely clear to you, Tom," she said. "I hate sport." Then we were plunged into darkness, and when, 2 hours and 12 minutes later, the lights were on, I could immediately see that the mascara was now streaming down Judith's face. "Oh, Tom," she said, "that was so lovely." But my story does not end there, or with the film's 4 Oscars some 10 months later. No, it concludes with a handwritten letter which suddenly came out of the blue from Ian Charleston. "You made a basically unathletic person look like an athlete. No mean feat," he said. That was a letter which I still have and which I will always cherish. Always.
It's interesting how those young actors that Tom helped to turn into athletes for a season continued their careers on film, stage and television, and they're well-known names today.